All right, so it's Dane Miller, a.k.a. Ghostface Miller, and I'm here with our first podcast. I've tried to do podcasts now two different times, once with my brother, once with Will Fleming, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I struggled mightily to actually hold myself accountable and hold my brother, hold Will, and vice versa accountable to actually do a podcast. So my goal is I've been consistently doing Dane Tip Tuesday every Tuesday on Instagram Live and on Facebook, and I've decided to try and turn that into the podcast of perpetual change. Basically, what I want this to turn into is just, you know, a discussion of who I am, who my family is, my gym, my supplement companies, my other business ventures, my farm, my you know, sister's life, my brother's life, my parents' life, and anybody that we bring on the show, anybody of any nature that has an impact on me that we would bring on, and we could discuss different topics. But what I wanted to do is just start this, and I'm still up in the air with the podcast title. I do actually really like the podcast of Perpetual Change, but I'm not too certain yet if that's going to be what I go with moving forward. But I think for the first couple podcasts, I want to turn it into just, you know, the same things that we've been doing with Dane Tip Tuesday, where we give people a peer into my brain and into the gym that is Garage Strength, and what we do with various different sports on a very high professional level of training. You know, we got shot putters, discus throwers, wrestlers, Olympic weightlifters all over the place. We've got stud high school football teams and all of these areas. So, you know, we can go into discussions about all that, but, you know, I want to keep this similar to start off and then just see where it goes and grows into over, you know, hopefully I can do this consistently for a long time and not flake out like I have been. So I want to go into some of the questions I've already received from the Dane Tip Tuesday questions that we get in our direct message in Instagram and via Facebook and even sometimes via email. So Dane, what are the best fixes for an early arm bend? This is something that I think I struggle with myself, and a lot of coaches struggle to cue athletes on is getting rid of that arm bend, and when it's a priority to get rid of that arm bend, and at and how to get rid of the arm bend. you know, I have an athlete right now, Jules Rioto, who's just an absolute monster. She's a 75K lifter. This morning she actually front squatted 145 kilos, which is 319. You know, she's 19 years old. She's clean and jerked 120 kilos. She snatched 97 kilos. So she's very legit, but we got rid of it in her snatch, but we haven't been able to figure it out in her clean and jerks yet. It's getting better. It is improving, but it hasn't, you know, dissipated. And in the meantime, I have a couple other athletes that are younger that I've been working on with different cues and different variations. And I've found that for them, the best cue is obviously, you know, long arms. I like to think long arms, active lats off the floor. And as that bar is passing the knee, because right before the brush point is typically when these athletes start to have their arm bend. So they'll bend those arms and they'll almost row the bar into their hips. And what I've been cueing the younger athletes on is those long arms and long lats or tight lats, long arms. And then as that bar passes, I want them to actively curl their wrists into their body. So it's, you know, that wrist curl can get their mind or body away from that arm bend. So I found like the active wrist curl back into their knees helps keep the bar tighter, and it prevents them from actually bending their elbows. A couple other things I've found that have helped and improved Jules pull is you know, cleaning off two boxes, cleaning off of one box, low hangs, And that same exact cue. Jules is still doing it. Power clean, she actually does it a little bit less. And I just think it's going to take time because it was so imprinted in her nervous system that it's going to take a process. So to answer that first question, that's I really, really like that the wrist curl back into the hips. What are the importance of lifting variations? I've noticed that your gym does a lot of variations. So what I like to do is I like to use variations for various technical issues. If somebody has a technical problem, I prefer to use variations instead of technical drills. I also think it adds a little bit of spice or whatever you want to call it to training. It's not as mundane then. I mean, it's still mundane, but it's not as terrible as it can be when you're just snatching or cleaning and jerking all the time over and over again. So I like to use variations predominantly because of the fact that I find that they work wonders as far as fixing technique. Now, the problem is, as a coach, you've really got to understand what are the variations that you need to be using for certain technical inefficiencies, and the athlete needs to understand that as well. If the athlete can understand that, the goal, then if the athlete understands the goal going forward with each variation, then they understand the transfer of that variation to the competitive movement. So that's the main reason why I like using lifting variations. I also like using lifting variations because I found that there's specific movements in the snatch or the clean and jerk that actually work better for other sports, specifically throwing. So it doesn't always have to go back to snatch is the best movement or clean is the best movement or jerk's the best movement because there are variations that are just as good, if not better. That's a weird question I got. Why do people teach the row? I don't really know what that means. I don't know if there's like, this is one thing in the weightlifting world I've found that there's always like some fringe groups teaching really strange, odd technical cues that I just don't know where they come from, and I don't know how they get people to buy into them either. Dane, why don't you cue your athletes on dropping under the bar, especially your youth athletes? Okay, that's a good one. I don't like to cue athletes, especially my youth athletes, like developing athletes, on dropping under the bar. I don't even know if I've ever even coached the third pull. I know a lot of people say it, but I'm not really sure if I've ever even said that to any of my athletes ever. And ironically, I've had coaches messaging me saying, "Dane, we got to get that. I got to learn that drop, how you get your athletes to drop under the bar." And this is where I think variations come into play. I don't teach getting under the bar or pulling under the bar mainly because I believe there's variations that we can use, such as no contact movements, power movements, speed off of boxes like two boxes, one boxes, various movements like that can help you improve getting under the bar. But I also just think if you can think about finishing on a lift, and then especially on a clean, it's typically the clean that we're talking about dropping under the bar. If you can finish a clean, and then I like to cue on fast elbows wrapping around the bar. If you can cue on fast elbows, they typically are going to have a tighter abdomen, tighter upper back, tighter lower back when they're pulling. So I don't like cueing athletes to drop under the bar for the fact, the main reason that once you start cueing young kids on that, they typically don't finish as well as they should be because they're thinking about a movement later on in the sequence. So that's again why I like using variations because there's variations that can teach how to properly drop under the bar. Let's get to this next question. How much stress and technique should Olympic weightlifters go through, or how much should you stress technique in Olympic weightlifting when training throwers, football players, and wrestlers? Okay, this is actually a great question. I think this is an awesome question. I think to start, I believe it does depend on the sport and the setting that you're training them in. So, for example, I'm training this high school football team in the area in a setting of, you know, 50 to 60 athletes, okay? So when we first start back up after the season's over, we will spend 2 to 3 weeks hounding snatch and clean technique. And it mainly comes down to, with high school kids, hounding snatch and clean mobility. Not as much technique, but mobility. If they have the mobility to hit positions, then they have the intelligence or body awareness or body intelligence to learn how to do those movements, because we do them so frequently. So I really like to, in a large setting, hound for 2 to 3 weeks over and over and over again every single day that they're lifting that those technical aspects. But after about, you know, let's say 3 to 4 weeks, we start to ease back a little bit. But then throughout the season or throughout the off season, we still consistently provide cues and provide movements that can, if, you know, if I see the group as a whole is doing things poorly or they're hitting poor positions, then I'm gonna change the way I'm training or give them a little bit different cues. But now for wrestling, again, it depends on the athlete. You know, a lot of wrestlers are internally rotated because of the stance that they get in. Especially American wrestlers tend to have this internally rotated, you know, upper shoulder, upper back position with their hands in tight, whereas Europeans that are more orthodox tend to have a little bit more solid back. But for wrestlers, I really like working technique with snatches, and a lot of power cleans and a lot of full cleans, because I think it mimics where they're at with a front load, a heavy front load, and what they're doing with double legs and stuff like that. So I do believe it's important to spend, you know, 4 to 8 weeks hammering it in the technical side. But at the same time, you can have weight on the bar and still make technical progress and strength progress just from that technique point. You know, that's like one of the big misconceptions of Olympic weightlifting is that, you know, football coaches be like, oh, it's so hard to teach these kids this stuff. And it's like, you realize that you can make technical improvements on the platform lifts, and the load might be really low, and those technical improvements are actually going to lead to strength gains, because they're going to improve their mobility, they're going to hit deeper range of motions, they're going to lengthen their muscles, which then in turn, you know, lead to greater activation of the nervous system. So those things need to be factored in when you're hammering the technique with football players. Now, moving into throwers. Throwers tend to have the absolute worst technique on the planet, and with Olympic weightlifting, I like to hammer throwers to have better technique, because I want them to learn the value of learning technique just as they need to value the technical improvements that they should be making in the circle. So we will spend a fairly decent amount of time working on technical progress, and it honestly just matters, you know, athlete to athlete, how long it takes to fix their technique. Some of these athletes that we were getting, I mean, Rachel Fatherly, like she couldn't even snatch. She couldn't catch a power snatch when she first started training with me. It took me a year to get her to just snatch in the hole. And that's incredible progress. And I could have stopped and said, no, I don't want to improve your mobility. I don't want to improve your mobility in the deep range. I don't want to do any of that. We're just going to forget about it. But that's not, you know, mastery of sport, and that's not progressive at all. So as far as throwers, I like to constantly be hounding them with technique so that they learn the absolute importance and the value that you know, technical progress can provide. When is it appropriate to program a lift you know your athlete will destroy, and destroy in a positive sense? Okay, so let's actually use Rachel again in this case. Is that, you know, Rachel's got a deadlift that, yeah, she's deadlifted twice in let's say the last year and a half, and she's deadlifted 455 pounds in those 2 days. Okay, so why should I program deadlifts into her program when she's so good at them? So this question is, would I do that? And if I would, when would I do it and why? Now, I guess the poor thing here is that I don't value deadlifts for throwers at all. I don't value them really even for football players. I don't really think that they have a great transfer of training when compared to the Olympic lifts, especially clean pulls. You know, I always like doing clean pulls or snatch pulls before I'll have them do deadlifts. So using, you know, an example where I might have a shot putter who's got a really good jerk or something, I really like to program movements that they excel with when they're trying to set up a peak, the flip side to this is the deadlift I would never program for Rachel to peak off of because I don't believe it has a good transfer training for throwing, and I don't believe that it would help Rachel peak. So I have to factor in what lifts I want to use for a peak with an individual. And if those lifts, you know, let's say a jerk, I notice when somebody's jerk is improving that their competitive movements or their competitive lift or their competitive throw is improving as well. They're getting more confidence in the weight room and things like that. Well, that's when I'm gonna program that exercise to make sure that, you know, they feel good mentally and they feel strong and they are strong and they're moving weights fast, heavy weights fast for a good strong peak. So I typically don't like to program movements that somebody can really, really destroy all the time. But at the same time, I also like to factor in, you know, one of those movements might be a clean or a snatch for an Olympic weightlifter. And obviously I've got to work with that. I got to work around that. So, and I'm going to cater to that as well, because that's part of their competitive movement. So it really just depends on each athlete and where we're at in their training blocks and what the goals are for that specific program. But yeah, that's actually a pretty good question. I don't feel like I really answered it, but I hope I got you guys a little bit of information in that regard. Actually the following question, why don't I program the deadlift? So I don't program the deadlift, you know, unless I have a power lifter, because I know that I can have an athlete clean, I can have an athlete snatch, I can have an athlete front squat, snatch grip, high pulls. Movements like this, back squat, high bar back squat, these lifts all carry over to the deadlift, and they also carry over to other movements, not just the deadlift. A deadlift will not carry over to a clean. It won't carry over to a snatch. It won't carry over to anything. Nothing. I have never seen someone with a really good deadlift go in and hit a really good clean without ever cleaning. But I've seen a lot of athletes with really good cleans that never deadlift, and they go in and they can deadlift a ton of weight. And a perfect example is Jake Horst, never deadlifts. He's a 2016 U.S. National Champion, 62K class, never deadlifts. He weighs 138 pounds, and he deadlifted 420. Never deadlifted before, okay? That's impressive, and that shows the transfer of training of the Olympic lifts to the power lift movements. Another example would be Sam Mattis, deadlifted 700 pounds at the Pennsylvania Power Festival this year. He hadn't deadlifted in over 2 years. All we've been doing, snatches, cleans, front squats, back squats. So the transfer of training factors in. All of those lifts boosted his deadlift, and he still pulled 700 pounds. Now, if we would have been focusing on his deadlift, I don't think he would have improved his squat. He wouldn't have improved his front squat. He wouldn't have improved his clean or his clean technique. He wouldn't have improved his snatch. So it really, that's the main reason why, not that I hate the deadlift, but I just don't program it, because there's better ways to train for the deadlift than deadlifting. You know, occasionally I'll program it with my powerlifters because there still has to be some technique involved. Not occasionally, more than occasionally I'll program it with my powerlifters. But even with my CrossFitters, I still won't typically program the deadlift, because clean pulls can transfer to a deadlift and to your clean. So that's sort of where I'm at with all that stuff. So one more question is this is sort of funny, is the question is, what's going on at Garage Strength? I don't I think it's funny that that question was posed. What's going on at Garage Strength? And then they proceed to say, there seems to be everything going on. Food, nutrition, supplements. What exactly is going on in that place? So I think this is a point where for my goals, I want to share my goals with everybody, is that I have a vision that I want to, you know, I own a farm and I want to produce, and I am producing eggs on my farm. I have produced, you know, pasture-raised pork, pasture-raised turkeys, chickens, ducks, all these things on my farm. And I provide that for my clients because it's, you know, scientifically shown that pasture-raised animals have a little bit more protein, have a little bit more vitamin A, a little bit more vitamin E than conventionally raised farm animals, and it's also healthier for the environment. But on top of that, my life goals is that I want to turn my business, my gym, Garage Strength, into basically a privatized regional training center for three or four different Olympic sports, you know, wrestling, Olympic weightlifting, and throwing. And over time, I've decided, you know, initially about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, with Garage Strength, we had been, you know, we sell raw milk on site, we sell our pasture-raised eggs, we sell grass-fed beef and livestock on site, and we provide all these great food sources for our clients. But we also got to the point where we had been buying supposedly grass-fed whey products, whey protein, for athletes to help supplement their products. And that's sort of where our sponsorship with Earth Fed Muscle comes in, of this podcast, obviously. But I sat there and we had gotten the supplement company Lab. It was a company called One World Way. I don't even know if they still exist. They might, but they're a fraud. They lied about what was in their product. They were just selling maltodextrin. It was 25 grams of maltodextrin with 5 grams of protein. So it was super, super sweet. But it product got, gets lab, comes back that it's not actually whey protein. So what do? I decided that the only way that I can trust any supplement company is to create my own. And we created Earth Fed Muscle. So Earth Fed Muscle was born out of this fraud of a company, One World Way, owned by Synergistic Nutrition. So Earth Fed Muscle was started mainly because I started to fear the fact that I've got athletes that are getting tested by WADA and USADA on a regular basis, you know, bi-weekly, getting drug tested. So I had to form a company that I could trust and that I could value what we were, you know, producing, and the high quality of supplements were well-rounded and a good line for my athletes specifically and even my family. So that's sort of where the birth of Earth Fed Muscle came from. And you know, now we use it here at Garage Strength, and we use every product at Garage Strength, and we use Earth Fed Muscle to help our athletes recover and make huge gains and be the strongest gym in the East Coast. I truly believe that too, that we are the strongest gym in the East Coast. And then finally, we want to use Earth Fed Muscle and some of my other online business ventures, you know, my online business with Garage Strength, to hopefully fuel and privately fund the next stage of Garage Strength. You know, we just moved into this great gym that we're in right now. It's a huge warehouse. It's 10,000 square feet. It's awesome. It's perfect for where we're at right now. And the goal is that within 5 to 7 years, I can move out of this and move to the next level of working towards that long-term goal of developing, you know, regional training center that's a little bit bigger and a little bit more advanced, and the facilities are a little bit bigger as well. So that's sort of where we're at with Garage Strength right now, and it's, you know, it's a lot of work, obviously, but I want to hustle and I want to achieve my dreams and get working on everything. So I'm going to call it there with the first episode of Dane's Perpetual Change, and just try and field more questions week to week. We're going to post this blog on, this podcast on my blog. I'm going to put it on Facebook. I'm going to put it on my website. Obviously, I put it on Instagram and all that stuff. And then hopefully we can work towards this evolving vision I have of where the podcast can go and start bringing on guests and discussing things of where we're going and where we're constantly adapting as human beings and what we can do nutritionally, what we can do socially to improve, you know, the world and the surrounding area, and what we can do from an athletic standpoint to continue to improve and advance ourselves from a training perspective as well. So stay tuned. I want to next week. We're going to do Dane Tip Tuesday next week again on the podcast of Perpetual Change. Peace.